Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The redacted version of the Mueller report is now public. Hundreds of pages laying bare how Russia interfered in the 2016 election and documenting a White House defined by chaos, bullying, and deceit. A president hell-bent on foiling the investigation. And yet, President Trump and his team declared victory.
No collusion, no obstruction. I'm happy.
There never was, by the way, and there never will be.
Before the report was even released, Attorney General William Barr echoed the president's refrain, no collusion. Barr told reporters Mueller had cleared the president on obstruction.
The evidence developed by the special counsel is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense.
A lot of legal observers and a lot of Democrats say otherwise, including House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler.
The special counsel made clear that he did not exonerate the president, and the responsibility now falls to Congress to hold the president accountable for his actions.
With his authority as chairman, Representative Nadler this morning issued a subpoena for the full unredacted report. Join us. What do you make of the findings from the redacted Mueller report? What does this mean in your mind for the Trump presidency? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebooks at OnPoint Radio. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Paula Reid, White House correspondent for CBS News. Paula, great to have you back.
It's so great to be back.
Also with us from Washington, D.C., Sahil Kapoor. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Sahil, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be back, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Paula, and Sahil.
You know, guys, it strikes me that one of the nice things is having 24 hours a little bit for this to seep in. We're not simply pulling yet one more page off the printer, hoping the toner, you know, holds for us to be able to read what's actually on there and going line by line, footnote by footnote. A day later, I want us to take stock of this and then move through what is likely to happen in ensuing days and weeks. So let's start with the notion, Sahil, you know, remind us, this was originally a report that was an investigation focused on the question of Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. What have we learned about the what the Russians did and what their links were or weren't to Trump world?
So the investigation broke down into the issue of collusion and coordination between the Trump campaign, including the president himself and Russia, and potential obstruction of justice. Attempts by the president and or his associates to try to squelch the investigation. And we learned that the Russians had made overtures to the Trump campaign to try to help them win the 2016 election, that figures in the Trump campaign were receptive to that. But the special counsel concluded that there was no specific arrangement, that there was no explicit arrangement between the two sides to coordinate beyond simply acting in each other's best interests. And under that extraordinarily high bar, he decided not to charge the president or not to recommend charges against the president for collusion. Now, the issue of obstruction of justice is much more complicated. The special counsel specified 10 episodes of potential obstruction, but again, did not specifically conclude that it was enough to charge the president. Again, a high bar here. The special counsel is dealing with the Office of the President of the United States, who the Justice Department has a longstanding guideline not to prosecute while he or she is in office.
How serious, Sahil, briefly, was the question of Russia's involvement? I mean, we've heard intelligence chiefs talk about this, but nonetheless, from the Mueller report, what is going to be in some ways the official record, you know, on its own merits, how serious was it?
It's extraordinarily serious. It fleshes out in great detail what intelligence agencies in the United States have suspected and concluded for a long time, that the Russians had tried to influence the 2016 election with the express purpose of damaging American democracy, damaging Americans' faith in their democracy, and helping President Trump win the 2016 election. And this report details all sorts of ways that they tried to do that.
Mm-hmm. Paula, you cover the White House. What does this show? What is the large picture, the broad strokes that we learned that emerged from this report about how the White House operates in its very nature?
Look, this is a Rorschach test, right? So the answer to that question depends on how you see the president, because depending on your feelings about President Trump, that's really going to dictate what you see in this report. Now, what I see as someone who deals with this day in and day out is this really fleshes out this picture of chaos. And actually, what was so interesting to me was how fearful the president was when he first heard that Robert Mueller had been appointed. When I was going through the report, that struck me as something new, as something surprising, because the president is always so defiant and dismissive of this investigation. But when Jody Hunt, Jeff Sessions' former chief of staff, now he has the civil division, he recounts this episode where Jeff Sessions tells the president Robert Mueller has been appointed. He describes how the president slumped down in his chair and said, "I'm effed. This is the end of my presidency." And that's something we haven't really seen, that side of the president and his reaction. We kind of knew about the chaos. A lot of this has been reported out. But it's just amazing to see how so often the people around the president are the ones who have to protect him from his own worst instincts. I know that because I cover the White House. But to the larger public, that's something new.
And you've also covered the investigation from the very beginning.
Yes.
It strikes me a little bit. You said the president said, we're effed. Last night, he and the White House seemed kind of buoyant by the fact that there had been no recommendation explicitly of an indictment. And there had been no explicit recommendation for impeachment to commence on the Hill, although it was sort of suggested in footnotes and in other passages there. Last night, the president said, basically anything the Russians did concerning the 2016 election was done while Obama was president. He was told about it, did nothing. Most importantly, the vote was not affected. It seemed like a victory dance. This morning, the president Trump was tweeting in a different key. He wrote, "Statements are made about me by a certain people in the crazy Mueller report itself, written by 18 angry Democrat Trump haters, which are fabricated and totally untrue." That's his characterization of the prosecutorial and investigative team working for the special counsel. And then later on, he called it an illegally started hoax and said some of the statements in the report are total BS, only he didn't say BS. He spelled it out in his tweets. Paula Reed, how is the White House interpreting this report, which he called, as we heard earlier, an exoneration?
Well, sort of a tale of two reactions, right? Both coming from the same man. Yesterday, the president took his victory lap. And politically, this is completely fair. He wants to take this message back to his supporters. Perhaps people are on the fence and say, "Look, I told you so. There was no obstruction. There was no collusion." Now, that's, of course, not exactly what the report said. No collusion. But on the question of obstruction, they said there was evidence on both sides. But then this morning, we saw the president once again sort of sinking into sort of fear and retribution and anger and sort of projecting his emotions. Again, I go back to the Rorschach test. I'm telling you, it fits for everybody. And how he feels about how he's portrayed in this report. And this was a concern that some White House officials had about how the president would take to certain things that had been shared with investigators if they became public. But it seems both politically and legally, it's probably best for the president to just do his victory dance and not start parsing out who said what in this report. Because, hey, if he has any evidence that anyone lied or fabricated material to the special counsel, he should present that, because that is, of course, a crime.
Our own guest, Paula Reed, at a press conference yesterday, pressed Attorney General Bill Barr to address the perception that, he has been protecting the president by redacting parts of the report and in the way in which he's been framing it. Let's hear how that exchange went.
"Here you have remarks that are quite generous to the president, including acknowledging his feelings and his emotions. So what do you say to people on both sides of the aisle who are concerned that you are trying to protect the president?"
"Well, actually, the statements about his sincere beliefs are recognized in the report that there was substantial evidence for that. So I'm not sure what your basis is for saying that I'm being generous to the president."
Jack Beatty, how convincing an answer is that from the attorney general?
It's a good answer from a defense lawyer, not from an attorney general charged with standing for the rule of law for the whole country. Mr. Barr has tarnished his reputation. This began a couple of weeks ago with that four-page summary and the objections to it by anonymous Mueller people. And now we saw it yesterday. And, of course, what will this mean going forward? I mean, will there be any effort from Justice Central to interfere with any of these 14 criminal referrals, only two public, that we now know from the report are going on? I don't know that Barr can be trusted on these matters.
We have a call now from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just curious, because I don't know the law on this, but given that Barr applied for the job promising to defend the president, and that basically yesterday he revealed that the president's team includes Sekulow, Giuliani, and himself, is there any potential legal recourse where Congress could potentially impeach him for lack of independence, or is he totally protected by Trump?
Let me throw that to Paula Reed, who used to cover justice. What do you say on that? And what do you say about the attorney general's performance itself?
So I agree with the interpretation. I was sitting right there. Clearly, he was very displeased with my question. He sounded like a defense attorney. He was giving such an empathetic interpretation of the president's actions. And I pointed actually to a Republican-appointed judge who had said just 2 days before that Barr had given the American public reason to be concerned about his transparency and who he was working for. And that's why I said both sides of the aisle have these concerns. I think these concerns are bipartisan. I think they will continue to grow. He's going to face questions. Now, the technicality on how you would remove him, I'm not exactly clear on that. And I think we're a ways off, right? A lot of this is subjective. Is it a crime that the attorney general went in and cherry-picked facts that look pretty favorable and sympathetic to the president? No, it's not. But it may undermine his sort of trustworthiness in the public eye. And this is coming at such a critical time for the Justice Department. The president has tried so hard to undermine trust in federal law enforcement as part of an effort to blunt whatever came out of this investigation. And William Barr is not helping that. Not only his own conduct, but these comments last week where he said, yeah, I think there might have been spying on the campaign. Whoa! The only person who says that is President Trump. He then backtracked and said, well, I'm looking into it. This is his second time as Attorney General. This smart man, he knows what he's doing. And I think the public outcry about how he's handling this is likely going to increase.
Well, we're sifting, as you can hear, through the redacted Mueller report. You can join our conversations. What lessons or truths do you take from the Mueller report? If this were any other president, how would the political fallout look? Different? The same? Are there ways in which this makes you feel better about the president you have? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at the Mueller report, redacted though it may be, and its implications for the Trump administration. You can join our conversation. How much of a victory dance should the president be doing right now? And how much do you agree with Attorney General Barr's declaration that President Trump did not obstruct justice? Why or why not? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook and On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Paula Reed. She is CBS News' White House correspondent, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, and Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. I want to start with a call from Portland, Maine. Peter is online. Peter, go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I'm surprised in the coverage that I've heard about the Mueller report that no one has discussed the way that Volume 2 lays out case against President Trump. It's very clear that the Mueller team and the Office of the Special Counsel was constrained in their charging decision. And I think non-attorneys might not get this, but what Mueller is saying is he wouldn't be permitted to bring charges against the president. That's why there isn't a charging decision. It isn't because there isn't a strong case for obstruction of justice. In fact, it looks like a multi-count indictment could be filed the day President Trump leaves office. And so I don't think he should feel confident at all about this, which may be why he's reacted so vehemently this morning against the report. I'm just surprised that I haven't seen any coverage about that or any discussion of it anywhere.
Peter, and you're an attorney yourself, is that right?
Correct, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for your call and your question. Let's throw that to Sahil Kapoor. Let's talk a little bit about that. In there, you know, it did seem as though the special counsel and his team were setting out the fact that they felt constrained by policy and practice from lodging any, you know, indictments against a sitting president of the United States, and that they essentially said, you know, this is something that could be looked at down the line. How do you think that affects how we should look at the strength of Mueller's conclusions?
Well, it's certainly a factor. Now, we know from the report, it's pretty clear that the special counsel was operating within the Justice Department framework that you tend not to indict a sitting president. And one of the most remarkable things in the report is that Mueller concluded that the president made repeated efforts to try to squelch the investigation by, for instance, trying to order the firing of the special counsel, ordering the firing of James Comey. These things could add up. But the special counsel concluded that the president was not successful in doing that. In other words, James Comey didn't end the investigation of Flynn. Don McGahn, the White House counsel, did not order the acting attorney general to tell the special counsel, that he be fired. So there is a determination from Robert Mueller that the president made attempts to do this, but that he wasn't successful at squelching the investigation. And of course, that factors in. Now, how people interpret that, I do think that's a political matter. That's a matter for ordinary people, for voters to interpret. That's a matter for Congress to pursue whether that kind of that kind of behavior by the president is worth investigating or doing more against, potentially impeachment, which would be the nuclear option for them, for Democrats in the House if they decide to go there.
And yet, Jack Beatty, he didn't take legal jeopardy off the table entirely for the president, right?
Not at all. And to Peter's point, there's a footnote on page 390 from the Mueller report. A possible remedy through impeachment for abuses of power would not substitute for potential criminal liability after a president leaves office. That statement that the president could be liable for criminal prosecution after he leaves office, that casts a shadow forward over the 2020 election. The only thing protecting the president from prosecution is the presidency. Under those circumstances, he has spoken before the 2016 election. He said, I may not accept the results. Will he say the same thing about 2020 if the consequences of losing could include criminal prosecution?
I'd like to take a call now from Norman, Oklahoma. Ann's on the air. Ann, what's your thinking about all this? Ann, are you with us? We've lost Ann from Norman, Oklahoma, but hopefully we have not lost the country. You know, we're getting comments online. NSTEF has posted a note. He says the GOP will never impeach Trump. My guess is the Democrats control the House. They could impeach Trump, but it would be tough to secure a conviction in the Senate. But it would not dislodge the president. And Steph goes on to write, I frankly would prefer Democrats in Congress to focus on highlighting a policy agenda that helps working class and middle class Americans who have so far not benefited from Trump's presidency. That's how we get a Democrat president elected, presumably, and Steph, a Democrat. In addition, you know, lawmakers are talking about issues like this. In a phone interview with NPR's All Things Considered yesterday, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, a California Democrat, says he doesn't expect a strong push in Congress for impeachment proceedings.
You know, that's a decision that would be above my pay grade, but I've always felt, and I think the Speaker feels this way as well, the evidence would have to be graphic and spark a bipartisan consensus that it warrants the president's removal.
Sahil Kapoor, what are you hearing on the Hill in terms of the appetite for Democrats to taking the fight to the White House, either through oversight or through exploring the idea of impeachment?
Well, I am told what House Democratic leaders want next is for Attorney General Barr and for Special Counsel Mueller to testify before Congress about this investigation. And I don't sense that the needle has moved on impeachment. Democratic leaders set a very high bar, which is that not only do you have to, you know, does the president have to have committed impeachable offenses? Not only do they need to rise to the level of needing to remove him from office, but there must be bipartisan consensus. And based on the reactions we've seen so far from Democrats and Republicans, there is nothing close to the Republican support that would be needed in the Senate to remove the president from office. Even if every Democrat supports conviction in the event of impeachment, you need 20 Republican senators. And the other point to that is that in the 2018 election, Democrats field tested the strategy of essentially ignoring the president and focusing on issues like health care, like taxes, like climate change. And it worked very well. They won 40 seats. They took back the House of Representatives. The voters who are not already persuaded, who are not already riled up by President Trump, are not going to be moved by talk of this investigation. They are more moved by kitchen table issues that affect them.
We have a comment on Facebook from Judy Blass. She writes, accept the results and move on. A number of folks have expressed that as well, that they feel that Democrats didn't get quite what they wanted and they should accept it. We have a call now from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Chris is on the air. Chris, what are your thoughts today?
Hi. I'm wondering if the panelists think that the Democrats and maybe especially the media overplayed their hands a bit and by emphasizing and hyping up the possibility of collusion with Russia so much that a report that without such hype really would have been shocking and really might have gotten bipartisan, you know, support for impeachment if they hadn't raised the expectation so much by hyping the possibility of collusion with Russia and even obstruction so much. I mean, a lot of what's in the report looks really shocking.
Mm-hmm.
But they played into the president's hands, and now he can claim vindication, right?
I think that's an excellent question. Thank you for that, Chris. I'm going to pose that to Paula Reed. She's not only covering the White House, not only been covering this report from the outset, but she's an attorney herself. Paula, right, what do you say?
So we've been reporting on the cases that have come out of the investigation. Six of the president's close associates have been charged. There's been a full trial. This is how a lot of this information has come out. So I'm not sure how we're not supposed to reveal that. Some people may interpret it as hype, but a lot of it was just reporting on what was happening. And the biggest question that was out there in terms of collusion was, which was, okay, if you weren't working together, why did over half a dozen of the people so close to the president, including his son-in-law, his closest advisors, cabinet members, why was everyone lying about Russia? What is going on there? And now we kind of get a little more insight. If you look at the Mueller report, really, it seems the bigger concern was obstruction. A lot of these people knew what the president was trying to do unsuccessfully behind the scenes. And that helped sort of inform why we got so many different lies about Russia. But again, it's a crime to lie to the media. But it's not a crime to lie to the media. It is a crime to lie to the special counsel. So now we're sort of getting the fuller narrative about why there was so much of an effort to cover up any sort of contact with Russia, even if, let's use Jeff Sessions as an example, his meetings with the Russian ambassador, pretty innocuous for a sitting senator. So why did he lie? But now we're seeing, I think there was a general concern about what was going on behind the scenes. Again, some people can see that as hype and maybe overplayed collusion, but it was an outstanding question. We tried to report what was going on through all these different prosecutions as it happened.
I mean, surely it's fair to say that, on social media, online, God knows on cable news, that there was an endless stream of punditry and analysis that veered into speculation and inference, right? And that things would build and build and build and people would build on each other to the point where we were – I'm not saying the media was doing this. I'm certainly not saying reporters were all doing this. But there were people offering thoughts that got ahead of where the facts ultimately took us.
Certainly. And I think that also happened in the Hillary Clinton email investigation. And there are questions and maybe a little bit of reflection that they'll all do about how we handle these kinds of cases. But what really I learned in going through this 400-page report was how a lot of the reporting, the real reporting from the New York Times, from the Post, from ABC, I'll also give CNN a shout out. They've done some great stuff, too. The Times, it was spot on.
And the Journal, too. You know, I want to play a clip now from one of President Trump's most loyal defenders, and that's a Republican Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina. The special counsel's report essentially said it did not find evidence to support that the idea that that the president or his camp conspired with the Russians to affect the 2016 campaign. But it did assert that the report didn't exonerate the president, and Congressman Meadows criticized the special counsel for saying that.
I think it was wrong to say, well, we can't prove that he did was not guilty. All we can say is we're not going to bring charges. That's really not up to him to do. He has the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the prosecutor, and yet we see that he didn't have enough proof to bring charges.
And to be clear and to clarify, in that moment, he's really criticizing the special counsel for not for saying that he did not exonerate the president on the question of obstruction of justice. Paula Reed, I want to draw upon your legal expertise once more here and drill down a little bit. How damning is the picture that the counsel painted of the president and his camp in terms of trying to foil his investigation in terms of the very question of obstruction of justice?
Pretty damning. They lay out 10 specific actions the president took or tried to take to obstruct this investigation. And they specifically say the only reason he didn't obstruct this investigation is because the people around him stopped him. They point specifically to former White House counsel Don McGahn, who allegedly received at least two calls from the president encouraging him to sack the special counsel, and McGahn refused. And again, Mueller lays out very carefully. He says, look, I found evidence on both sides of this issue. I cannot exonerate. But what's so important, it really what I think is going to be the next phase of discussion here and reporting, is when Attorney General Barr stepped in, he looked at the same evidence and said, no, there's not enough evidence here of obstruction. It's pretty clear. And we asked him yesterday, did you think that was something that Mueller meant to left to Congress? And he said, no, he didn't leave that to Congress. But then you look at the report once we got it. And clearly, Mueller said in the report, this is something that, Congress can take up, whether or not the president has committed a constitutional violation. So there's going to be a lot of questions about whether Barr clearing the president on this question of obstruction, if that's what Mueller intended, or if he was leaving this roadmap, this report for folks in Congress to pursue if they wanted to go down this path. And I can guarantee you, if and likely when Mueller testifies, it's going to be one of the biggest topics of discussion on the Hill.
One of the moments of the president's ire this morning in his tweets was saying he said, watch out for people who take so-called notes when the notes never existed until needed. That seemed to be a reference to Don McGahn, who the report reflected, the president's former White House counsel, who when he acknowledged he took notes, Trump sort of said, why? Why would you take notes? What lawyer would do that? McGahn had explained that's what good lawyers tend to do. Norman, Oklahoma, we have a call from you, and I think it's you back on the air. We're so glad to reconnect. What's your thinking about what's been playing out?
Well, you know, the way that I'm looking at it, and a lot of people in the Midwest, is that they did an investigation. The results came out. It's time to move on. If they are insistent on investigating something else, we're all curious about how this all started to begin with.
Mm-hmm. So that is the very nature of the investigation itself and some of the issues that the president and his supporters have raised.
Right. And okay. So that if they're going to investigate something, they can do that. Otherwise, they need to just move on and look at some of the issues in this country that are really affecting it, like illegal immigration, and they need to get together and get some things straightened out.
Well, Anne, thank you for contributing your perspective about that. What do you say, Jack Beatty? I mean, this is a report that says we're not going to call for any – we're not going to make any indictments on this, although there have been some referrals to other prosecutors, and they say that we're not explicitly recommending that the Congress take up impeachment. Is it time for the nation to move past what we've learned in the last few, you know, call it 24, 36 hours from the Mueller report?
Well, Anne, I think, speaks for the Republican perspective pretty clearly. On the Democratic side, it's interesting. Beto O'Rourke reports that of 550 questions he's taken recently, only two or three were about the Mueller investigation. Elizabeth Warren reports that of 275 questions at town hall, only three at town halls, only three were about Russia and Mueller. So those are tests of something, of perhaps of is it public indifference to this? Is it public fatigue of this? Is it that through the 2 years of Trump now, we have defined the presidency down to Trump so people aren't shocked, they aren't amazed, they want to talk about something else? We don't know how to read that, but I think it does support Anne's notion that people do, quote, want to move on.
I want to play a quick clip now of the White House press secretary, Sarah Sanders. She admitted, while speaking under oath to the special counsel's team, that she misled reporters in May 2017 when she said that the FBI director James Comey was fired because he had lost the confidence of the department.
I've heard from countless members of the FBI that are grateful and thankful for the president's decision. And I think that, you know, we may have to agree to disagree. I'm sure that there are some people that are disappointed, but I've certainly heard from a large number of individuals, and that's just myself. And I don't even know that many people in the FBI.
She was challenged on that several times by reporters. She stuck by it, and then she admitted to the special prosecutor's team that she had no basis for those statements. Sahil Kapoor, we've only got about a minute left before the break, but what did we learn in this report about the relationship of this administration to the truth?
Well, we learned that, you know, Sarah Sanders knows it is not a crime to lie to the press, but it is a crime to lie to the special counsel. And that, you know, it's a remarkable juxtaposition, because when you're the chief spokesperson for the White House, you're on that podium, your word means a lot. And the credibility is enormously important for someone in that position. And I think we're seeing here that Sarah Sanders, it appears, felt pressured by the president to justify his decision to remove James Comey. And she came up with an argument that she now admits was not founded in anything. I think this is going to inform how reporters view, you know, the press secretary when they're at that podium.
In past administrations, that would have cost a press secretary his or her job. Tough to know in the Trump years. We're discussing the week's top stories. You can join our conversation. We'll hear from a senator on the Senate Intelligence Committee about the Mueller report. Then what do you make of Attorney General William Barr's decision to withhold bail from asylum seekers? What do you make about the president's showdown with Congress over Yemen? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines of this week's top stories. In a few minutes, we'll talk about a couple other stories. Attorney General William Barr denies bail to asylum seekers, and President Trump vetoes a bipartisan push in Congress to end U.S. involvement in Yemen's civil war. What are your reactions? What are your thoughts about these things? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we'll return to our reporters roundtable in a few minutes to talk about those stories. But first, with us now from Brunswick, Maine, is independent Senator Angus King of Maine. He sits on the Senate Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. To be perfectly transparent, he typically caucuses with Democrats. Senator King, great to have you with us.
David, glad to be with you.
So if I'm not mistaken, the Mueller investigation, in fact, the investigation authorized by then FBI Director James Comey, started as a counterintelligence operation. You sit on the Intelligence Committee. What did we learn from the Mueller report publicly that we might not have known before?
Well, I think, of course, the Mueller report's basically divided up into two pieces. One is on the whole collusion, cooperation, conspiracy issue, and the second part is on the obstruction issue, which ironically grew out of the initial investigation. I think there's one point that the Mueller report makes very clear, and that is, and this has been, you know, sort of a conspiracy theory and a lot of discussion, particularly on the right, that somehow the whole counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign was illegitimate, and it started with the Steele dossier. And the truth is, it started with a guy who was working in the Trump campaign, talking to the ambassador of Australia and saying the Russians have dirt on Hillary Clinton, and you know, the combination of being in the Trump campaign and that Russians have dirt, and then very shortly thereafter, there was a big dump of hacked emails. That's when the FBI took the steps to say, wait a minute, this is something we've got to look into and we have to take seriously. So that's where it started. The Steele dossier didn't get to the FBI until something like September. This was in July of 2016. So that's the kind of detail that's in here that I think is going to be important in the ongoing discussion of this whole matter.
you're on the Senate Intelligence Committee. There was a report, I believe, yesterday by Politico saying that your chairman, Richard Burr, the Republican of North Carolina, had essentially briefed the president and the White House at some days after receiving what was to be confidential information, which was surprising to learn. You know, it seemed as though your Democratic leader, Mark Warner of Virginia, and Senator Burr have worked together hand in glove, and that there was not the kind of collaboration between the Republican lawmakers on your committee that you had seen on the other side of Congress over in the House, where Devin Nunes had come under a lot of criticism for being essentially an ally of the president in all this. What do you make of what we've learned about Chairman Burr's activities?
Well, I want to get more detail. It was the first I'd heard of that. It's concerning, obviously. It was very early in the process. I have to say, you know, I meet with Richard Burr twice a week for 4 or 5 hours, and along with the other members of the committee. It's inconsistent with the way he's conducted himself pretty much throughout this investigation. So I want to understand it better. It's concerning if it happened. But the question is, was it an ongoing cooperation with the White House, or was this an aberration? And I hope it's the latter. And obviously, it's something we have to talk about in the committee.
What do you see Congress doing next? Obviously, Democrats control the House, Republicans control the Senate, and yet there is this question looming. The special prosecutor mentioned the notion of oversight, mentioned the notion that Congress could take it up with impeachment, although he's noted a couple other possible legal paths as well. What's the right thing for Congress to do at this point?
Well, I do think that there are still some open matters that need to be examined. And our committee, by the way, the Senate Intelligence Committee, has not completed our work. We've interviewed over 100 witnesses, thousands of pages of testimony, and we're still following up on some of these matters. There are two things in the collusion part of the report that struck me as sort of undefined. One was Paul Manafort, according to the report, on more than one occasion supplied polling data and information about the campaign to a guy who was identified by the FBI as having connections to Russian intelligence. This was in August and September of 2016.
And of course, Manafort was for a stretch the chairman of the campaign.
The chair, exactly. And so my question is, what was he sharing and why? Because anybody that's been involved in a campaign knows that polling data, you know, the public hears polling data and they think, well, that means Trump was up by 4, Hillary's up by 6. No, polling data has things like which issues are working in which states, and the extent of the detail, to me, that would have been very significant in terms of guiding the Russian efforts, which, by the way, the report makes crystal clear the Russians were behind these efforts of disinformation and release of hacked emails. But the fact that that polling data, I was not satisfied with the provision in the report that I felt didn't examine that in sufficient detail. The other piece is there's a lot of redaction in that section that appears to be the Roger Stone material. It says in a pending matter, and that's it looks like it's Roger Stone. And I want more clarity on that in the sense that he appears, and again I'm saying appears, to have been a potential connection between the campaign and WikiLeaks. And to me, that's a dot that hasn't yet been connected. For example, the very day of the Access Hollywood tapes, remember the devastating tape of the president getting off the bus? Within hours of that, WikiLeaks dumped a huge amount of John Podesta's emails. Was that just a coincidence, or did somebody call and say, we need some help here?
It's Let's time to create some subject. Havoc for the Democrats, right?
And to me, that was such and I want to know more about what Roger Stone's role was, what kind of connections he had with Donald Trump. And that's all redacted in the report. And I think that's something that needs to be we need to understand that better.
Senator Angus King of Maine, thanks for joining us to answer our questions today. Sounds like you have a few of your own. Appreciate it.
Oh, I do have a few of my own, and I think they're also the questions of obstruction of justice, which we didn't get to. The Mueller sort of passed that over to the Congress. Bill Barr intercepted the pass and concluded on it, but I don't think he was correct. But the question now before us is, what do we do? My view is we wait until the elections of 2020. That's the ultimate people having the say over who they want as their president.
Senator Angus King of Maine, thanks so much.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Back with us, our Cracker Jack Reporters Roundtable with Paula Reed, CBS News White House correspondent, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, and Jack Beatty, our own news analyst here at On Point. I want to take very quickly a couple of calls on this and to close the chapter on it. Kate is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Kate, what are your thoughts here?
Hi, thank you. I guess I get very disappointed when I hear Senator King say, you know, we wait. And when Nancy Pelosi said he's just not worth it, which to me just indicates a level of cynicism that's just kind of horrifying, because I can't help but think about, first of all, it's just the politics thing, and it's this reactive stance that we won't do this because the Republicans won't do that. And it's just, at what point do you stand up for what's right and what's wrong? And I keep thinking of that horrible, and it's almost a cliche, sadly, at this point, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing. And I think at a certain point, you have to be a leader and stand up and say, this is just wrong. I mean, so many things he's done, as Jack said, defining the presidency down, he's done so many things along the way. And just to say, oh, you know, this will take care of itself, the guy is very busy putting in place things that are going to consolidate executive power, you know, and I just get horrified when they say they're not going to impeach. And I just find it, they're on so back on their heels, and it just, I don't like it.
All right. Thank you for sharing that, Kate. Appreciate it. Want to take a call, so call quickly from Spencer, Iowa. Jim, go right ahead.
Yes. I think that the Mueller report is completely incomplete without any testimony from the focus, which would be the president, Mr. Trump. And, you know, I think that anyone that's happy with this kind of result is somebody who's willing to accept the kind of just disinformation, this artful dodger president that, you know, he's the luckiest fool around. You know, nobody could get away with this sort of thing. But, you know, he's celebrating. And, you know, we're supposed to be happy that he got away without having to explain himself on one occasion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that call, Jim. We appreciate your sharing your thoughts. I want to move to a couple other big stories this week, also in some ways involving presidential authority, push and pull with Congress. Let's turn a little bit briefly to the question of Congress's overwhelmingly bipartisan vote to rebuke the president and pull back authority to operate in the civil war of Yemen. Sahil Kapoor, tell us a little bit about the president's veto and what the issue was.
So this was the second veto of Donald Trump's presidency. He called this resolution, I'm quoting here, an unnecessary, dangerous attempt to weaken my constitutional authorities, unquote. Now, the resolution had a couple of different aspects to it. One, there's a humanitarian crisis in Yemen that many members of Congress decided that the United States was essentially pouring fuel on the fire by supporting that Saudi-led war. The second aspect of this was there a number of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle that wanted to reassert Congress's war powers, which it has been gradually giving up. And the third aspect of it was many members, mostly Democrats, were upset with the way President Trump handled the alleged Saudi murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and the fact that he didn't hold the Saudi crown prince responsible. Again, Saudi Arabia is leading this war in Yemen, and I think there was a belief in Congress that this resolution would in part stand up to the Saudi crown prince.
I also want to turn now to the fight over the question of illegal immigration and treatment of people seeking asylums. Attorney General William Barr moved to withhold bail from asylum seekers who cross the border illegally, many of them just sort of surrendering voluntarily to seek asylum. Republican Representative Peter King of New York, he's no relation to the Senator Angus King we just spoke to, but Republican Representative Peter King of New York spoke on Wednesday on Fox News' America's Newsroom.
We can't take everybody in, and we have to look carefully at these asylum claims. As it turns out, many of them turn out not to be real, to be phony, but it gets the person in the country, and then they disappear or they come back 2 years later for a court hearing. So no, I think the Attorney General is doing what has to be done, and I fully support him.
Paula Reed, tell us about this fight. What's the Attorney General trying to do here?
What he's trying to do is deliver on this broader objective within the Trump administration to deter people from coming here and seeking asylum. The top White House official told me, I think it was last week, that they're frustrated with the Department of Homeland Security's inability to pursue some of their objectives to deter asylum seekers. And they were changing the leadership in the hopes of being able to make it harder to come here and to wait out this process that you go through when you claim you have a credible fear of returning to your home. So what I see here is Barr is just following the administration's policy and desire to make it as hard as possible to come here and successfully seek asylum. And even if you are able to get through that initial interview, they want you to be detained. Again, it's to deter people from coming here in the first place. Now, the important thing here is, though, this does not apply to families. And the administration has said, obviously, that is because there's a 20-day limit on detaining children. But this administration official told me that 20-day limit under Flores, that is something they're going to pursue. They want to be able to hold children longer, to be able to hold families longer, to, again, deter people from coming here and seeking asylum. Now, it also does not apply to anyone who comes through a legal point of entry and seeks asylum.
I want to take a call now from Buffalo, New York. Sarah, thanks for listening. What's your thoughts on all this?
I think one of the biggest things that we have to look at is when we talk about how illegal immigration impacts us, we're looking at the fact that people are coming here, and that has little impact on people in everyday life. A lot of people who are distressed about illegal immigration are like, oh, well, you know, these people are coming here, and there are all these kinds of stereotypes about, like, the impact and the number of people who are coming here for asylum illegally. And I think that if we focus on keeping people from being here, America has always been the kind of country to get involved in foreign affairs. So if we're not taking care of people here, it's going to cause us to use a lot of our resources and a lot of our time abroad. And I think that that's going to be more problematic than focusing on people here. I'm speaking as an ESL teacher, and I, you know, I have a lot of students who
English is a second language.
Some of them are here legally, and some of them I don't know their status. So I see that. Yes, you know, people coming here has an impact on some people's lives, but I guarantee it's not the level of impact that you kind of see in the media that the administration talks about. And I don't think more people want to be deployed to focus on some of the, like, getting rid of some of the reasons why people are coming here.
So. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that and for sharing your insights and experience there. Jack Beatty, take us out. Help us close out this hour. Talk to us a little bit about the extent to which this is a fight over policy and an effort in the, say, 45 seconds we have left to present politics before the president's fans and the larger voting public.
Well, it certainly is primarily politics, because this denying bail to this particular category doesn't begin to touch the numbers of people, which are 60% of these apprehended at the border are family units and unaccompanied minors. It's politics. The president's motto, his slogan for one of them for 2020 is, "I'll protect you." And what he's going to protect us from are people coming across the border.
You've been listening there to Jack Beatty, On Point's own news analyst. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
We've also been talking to Sahil Kapoor, a national political reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks for your insights as well.
Thank you, David.
And we've also had Paula Reed. She's CBS's White House news correspondent. Appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated. and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.